This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most HIV researchers believe that our best hope for bringing the worldwide AIDS epidemic under control is a vaccine. But it's been very difficult to create a vaccine that's effective against HIV. We invited David Baltimore to explain why. Baltimore is the chair of the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee. He's also the president of the California Institute of Technology. He's been studying HIV since 1985. In 1975, he won a Nobel Prize for Medicine with two other biologists for discovering reverse transcriptase, the key enzyme which allows retroviruses like HIV to multiply. So here's David Baltimore's explanation of why it's been so difficult to develop an AIDS vaccine.
The AIDS vaccine has been difficult to develop because HIV, the cause of AIDS, is a remarkable virus. It's a virus that seems to have understood the kinds of mechanisms that we would use to control it and protected itself against those mechanisms. So one of the ways that we protect ourselves against most viruses is by making antibodies. And most viruses are sensitive to antibodies and are killed by them. HIV is largely, not entirely, but largely insensitive to antibodies. And it's very hard to induce in a person or an animal antibodies that will kill HIV.
Why is it insensitive to antibodies? What makes the HIV virus different from other viruses?
Well, it's found a number of ways of hiding itself from antibodies. One way is that it's got a coating of sugar around it. Most viruses are, in fact, all viruses basically have a protein coat around them, and that protein is the target of antibodies, and it's very variable, so each virus looks different than every other virus to the immune system, to the antibody system. But the HIV has taken its protein and covered it with sugars. And it does that by just chemically adding sugars on top of the protein. And so the bulk of the protein is not available to antibodies. It's sort of a stealth process by which the virus has coated itself with something that the immune system can't recognize. The immune system can't recognize the sugars because they're ordinary body sugars. There's nothing special about them. And we're tolerant to our own bodies. We don't make antibodies to ourselves. We shouldn't. If we do, we get autoimmune disease. And so what the virus has done is taken advantage of that tolerance to sugars to put self-sugars around it. Now, they can't be entirely coated with sugar because then it wouldn't be able to bind to a cell and get into a cell. So it's got to have an Achilles heel. And there is an Achilles heel in it. But it seems to be covered with highly variable sequence so that every time an antibody is made that does work, the virus changes itself a little and hides from that antibody. So it's a combination of the sugar and the variability that leads the virus to be so insensitive to antibody. There may be other aspects to what we don't understand yet, but that present-day research indicates that.
Now, early this year, virus researchers traced the source of HIV to chimpanzees in Africa. And these researchers believe that a monkey virus jumped species and then mutated into the AIDS virus. Are there any implications of that for the development of an AIDS vaccine?
Well, not really, because if HIV were not the kind of virus it is, that is, if it were more open in structure and more available to the immune system, then the fact that it jumped from one species to another would not matter so much. But there is something very fundamental, I believe, about a virus that has jumped from one species to another, and it'll take me a moment to explain it. Most viruses that we get are only actually grow in human beings. So polio only grows in human beings, and mumps only grows, and measles only grows in human beings. And they're viruses that are very highly adapted over many, probably hundreds of thousands of years, to the human species, and they utilize transmission mechanisms that are part of our social structure. When we shake hands, we transmit viruses. When we cough in crowded circumstances, we transmit viruses. Children transmit viruses when they play with each other. And the viruses have all adapted to be transmitted in those ways. So there's this high adaptation of the virus to the human culture. Now, another virus coming into human beings will not in general be transmitted very effectively. So, for instance, you remember there was a great flap over the swine flu a number of years ago, and people had caught influenza virus from pigs, which is, in fact, where flu comes from. And the virus did not transmit itself from one person to another. And so, although some people got sick from it, it didn't really create an epidemic. That's true of most viruses that we get from animals. Ebola virus, a very heavily infectious virus, tends to burn itself out in that way. So the adaptation to humans produces what I call an equilibrium situation, in which the virus and the human are in equilibrium with each other, and the virus knows how to get itself transmitted and live with us, and we know how to kill it off and make sure it doesn't kill us off. When a virus comes in from somewhere else, it is not in equilibrium. And sometimes that virus is transmitted effectively, and HIV is a case where it is transmitted effectively. And the virus finds itself in a strange circumstance, and it starts trying to adapt to that circumstance. So HIV is constantly mutating, trying to figure out how to become a human virus, but it'll take presumably many, many generations for that to happen. And meanwhile, the virus is in this strange circumstance, causing a kind of devastating disease that a virus that's in equilibrium never causes. So human-adapted viruses are not a big problem. Viruses coming in from elsewhere are often a big problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David Baltimore. He's the president of Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. He's also the chair of the National Institute of Health's AIDS Vaccine Committee. What are you most hopeful about now in terms of possible AIDS vaccines on the horizon?
I'm hopeful about two things. One is that there was a recent report from a guy named Dr. Nunberg in Montana that he has figured out a way to catch the virus halfway between being the sort of inert particle that's transmitted between people and being inside a cell. He's caught the virus on the outside of a cell, and there it has a somewhat different structure and may be much more sensitive to antibodies. And he has good evidence now in mice, so it's just the earliest experimental evidence, that if you take recently infected cells and use them as an immunogen, that they will induce antibodies that are actually quite effective against the virus. If that's, I think, is a great lead, because it suggests a whole new way of inducing antibody, and antibody is something we really want to have in a vaccine if we can possibly do it.
And what's the second thing you're hopeful about?
Cytotoxic T lymphocytes. These are cells that kill infected cells. They're cells in our body that kill infected cells. And that's an arm of the immune system that no one's ever designed a vaccine around, because it's really only been recently recognized how important it is. And the evidence about how to deal with how the cytotoxic T lymphocytes actually see virus-infected cells, how they kill virus-infected cells, how memory of an infection is maintained, all of that is very new. And so I'm very hopeful that with that new evidence, we'll be able to design vaccines that elicit the cytotoxic T lymphocyte response and can deal with the infection that way. It's a very new area. There's no good proof of principle in it, but I'm very hopeful that it's going to be an important part of the design of a vaccine.
Would you explain that cytotoxic T lymphocyte response?
Cytotoxic T lymphocytes are cells that we all have in our body that go looking around for cells that have been infected by something foreign. And what happens is that cells that are infected present on their surface evidence that they're infected. Little peptides, little pieces of the virus end up on the surface of the cell. And the cell is actually displaying them there so the cytotoxic T lymphocytes can see them. And they see this foreign structure and they say, aha, this is a cell we've got to kill as quickly as we can. So the cytotoxic T lymphocytes grabs onto the cell and injects stuff in the cell that actually causes the cell to commit suicide.
And can you explain a little bit about how the vaccine would replicate that response?
Well, what the vaccine would do would be to let me go back for a second. To make a vaccine that can induce cytotoxic T lymphocytes, What we have to do is educate a population of cytotoxic T lymphocytes to see HIV. And the way they would see it is on the surface of supposedly infected cells. So we've got to produce, as a vaccine, cells that look like they've been infected by HIV, that are presenting these peptides on their surface as if they were infected by HIV, but of course without an HIV infection. And we can do that by putting the HIV proteins into another virus which itself is not dangerous. For instance, vaccinia virus, which is the virus we use to protect ourselves against smallpox, or we used to before we got rid of smallpox, is a wonderful carrier for HIV proteins. And people are now developing vaccinia-like viruses as carriers of HIV proteins, getting them inside cells, getting them expressed on the surface of cells, activating cytotoxic T lymphocytes to see them, and then hoping that there'll be a memory population of cytotoxic T lymphocytes socked away in the immune system, ready to respond when there's a real HIV infection.
Do you still think that an AIDS vaccine is our best hope for ending the epidemic, or at least limiting the epidemic?
I absolutely believe that a vaccine is the only thing that will ultimately limit this epidemic, or in fact get rid of the virus if it works right. And I'm not alone in that. I think almost everybody in the field now believes that without a vaccine, we're going to have an epidemic that is uncontained and that will make HIV the most serious infectious disease in the world.
Now, I think that the only vaccine that has reached what's called phase 3 testing, which involves large-scale tests on humans, is the Vaxgen vaccine. What principle does that vaccine work on?
That works on the principle of making a protein which looks like the outside of HIV and trying to stimulate antibodies with that protein. It doesn't at all address the cytotoxic T lymphocyte arm of the immune system, and it basically is using a type of immunogen which has not worked very effectively in clinical testing up to now.
So
it's very safe,
mm-hmm.
and so nobody's being put at risk with it, but I think the probability of it being effective is relatively low.
My guest is David Baltimore, the chair of the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Baltimore, the chair of the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee. What is one of the big disappointments that you've faced on the AIDS vaccine front, and what did you learn from that disappointment that might be helpful to the development of a vaccine?
Well, one thing I've learned is that it is hard to marshal the scientific community
mm-hmm.
to focus its attention on a practical problem like making an HIV vaccine, particularly when it's such a difficult problem. And it's built into the culture of the scientific community that people prefer to work, and I for myself prefer to work on the more theoretical problems of how the immune system functions, of how viruses work, rather than on a practical problem like making a vaccine. The career paths in the scientific community don't really offer an opportunity for people who want to do something practical unless they're willing to go into a company. And
you mean like a drug company?
Like a drug company that's focusing on a vaccine. And when you go into a drug company, you can often be terribly disappointed when the elders of the company decide that they want to stop going in the direction you're interested in and go in some other direction. You don't have much freedom to decide what you want to do. The great advantage of being in the academic world is that you have the freedom to say, I want to go in X direction and I'm going to do it. And all I have to do is get some money from somebody to do it, and then I can do it. So you've got a lot of freedom in the academic community, although the need to raise your own money. In a company, you don't have that kind of freedom, but you do have a lot of money. And I would have liked to have seen more people in the academic community focused on a vaccine. What we've done since it is hard to find that career path is to encourage the National Institutes of Health to start a new laboratory which is focused on vaccine development. And in fact, they've just announced the new director for that laboratory. The laboratory is now being built, And I think it's one of the great accomplishments of the my committee to encourage the development on the NIH campus of a laboratory that's focused on this practical and very difficult problem.
So that laboratory would fund researchers to work on an AIDS vaccine?
No, it'll actually provide a home for them to work, not just fund them. We in fact, do fund people there's about $200 million now in the budget this year for funding HIV vaccine work, and there are a lot of people around the country doing it. But there have been very few centers developed, and a lot of the most creative people have sort of avoided it. The vaccine laboratory at NIH will be a home where people will have the long-term opportunity to focus their attention on bringing the new information of immunology and virology to bear on this very practical and difficult problem.
Now, I was reading that there's a vaccine that's a possibility that instead of preventing AIDS, would prevent an infected person from actually getting AIDS. In other words, they could be infected with HIV, but it wouldn't develop into AIDS. They wouldn't succumb to it.
Right. In fact, my belief is that that's the kind of vaccine that we will get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'll actually be able to prevent infection. I think what we'll get is a vaccine which will ameliorate the infection to the point where people don't come down with AIDS or come down with AIDS slowly over very long periods of time.
And the vaccines that you were discussing fit into that category?
That's right. I don't think any of them are what we call sterilizing vaccines, producing sterilizing immunity, which means that you never get infected by the virus. In fact, almost no vaccine really gives sterilizing immunity. The polio vaccine, for instance, doesn't prevent initial infection. What it does is to get the immune system revved up so before the virus can get into the nerves, the virus is eradicated in the body. But the person's actually been transiently infected.
My guest is David Baltimore, and he's the president of the California Institute of Technology, and he chairs the National Institute of Health's AIDS Vaccine Committee. Now, you won a Nobel Prize for discovering the retrovirus?
No, discovering an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which is the key enzyme that allows retroviruses to multiply and really gives the name retro to retroviruses.
And HIV is a retrovirus.
And HIV is a retrovirus.
So how did your discovery relate to what we now know about HIV?
Well, we were very lucky that Howard Temin and I, when we jointly made the discovery and shared the Nobel Prize, that we found reverse transcriptase at the time we did. Because this was 1970. By 1982, we had become aware of the AIDS epidemic. The way that the investigators, both in France and the United States, found HIV was looking for the reverse transcriptase because it was the most characteristic signature of a retrovirus. Had HIV appeared in our community in 1965 instead of early 1980s, that is, before we knew about reverse transcriptase, there would have been nothing to look for. We would have been in a very serious situation of having a major epidemic that we knew was occurring and being unable to find the organism that was causing it because we had no model for what to look for.
What is reverse transcriptase?
It's an enzyme. It's a protein which allows the copying of RNA into DNA. Now, I can explain all of that. But as I think everybody's aware now, DNA is the carrier of genetic information inside cells and inside our bodies. But the way that DNA functions is by making copies of itself into a molecule called RNA, which is actually very similar to DNA chemically. And what HIV does is to use RNA as its genetic material instead of DNA. But when it goes inside a cell, it copies that RNA into DNA. And that's why it's called reverse transcription, because the synthesis of RNA from DNA is called transcription. This process of reverse transcription allows the virus now to be inside a cell as a DNA copy, and that DNA integrates into the chromosomes of the cell and becomes just a set of genes in the cell, like any other genes that we carry in our body. And then every time that cell multiplies, the DNA multiplies, and so you get more infected cells as a consequence of the multiplication of the originally infected cell.
Well, that's a really brilliant thing for a virus to do.
It is brilliant. It's, when we first realized that that was going on, we were in awe of how insightful evolution had been in producing this mechanism.
So it's just this brilliant breeder.
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, the consequence of that is that infected cells can stay around for a very long time inside people. Uh-huh. And that's one of the reasons why the drugs that we're using against HIV have not really eradicated it in infected people, because the virus can sit there in this hidden form for long periods of time.
David Baltimore chairs the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee and is the president of the California Institute of Technology. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Baltimore, the chair of the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee. Baltimore shared a 1975 Nobel Prize for Medicine for discovering reverse transcriptase, the enzyme that allows retroviruses like HIV to invade our cells and multiply. Now, are there any vaccines that are being researched or medications that are already in use that can prevent this demonic replication that you've just described?
Well, sure. The bulk of the drugs that are effective against HIV are inhibitors of reverse transcriptase. AZT, DDI, DDC, 3TC, all of those are inhibitors of reverse transcriptase. And what they do is they prevent the virus from making the copy of itself when it gets inside the cell, so that effectively it aborts the infection. And they're very, very effective at doing that.
If they're so effective, how come they're not effective enough?
Well, because some cells, there are two reasons they're not effective enough. One is that the virus can mutate. And so you treat a patient with AZT and the virus mutates so that the reverse transcriptase is no longer sensitive to AZT. So then you've got to switch to another drug, and you really never stay ahead of the virus. And that's why we use multiple combinations now. You try to drive the virus down to zero as fast as you possibly can so that it doesn't have a chance to mutate. And you also hit it in two or three different ways so that even if it mutates against one, it's still sensitive to another. So that's one of the reasons. The second reason why the drugs are not totally effective is because there's a small population of cells in a person that have gone through the reverse transcriptase process, transcription process. They have this DNA copy inside the cell, and they're not expressing it. It's just sitting there quietly. Sometime later, and that later can be months, probably even years later, the virus may get activated again. And suddenly now this cell will produce virus that has been harboring this DNA copy over this very long period of time. And there are no drugs that can get at that because it's insensitive to reverse transcriptase inhibitors because the reverse transcription has already occurred.
Boy, these viruses are smart.
This virus particularly is smart. Every time we hit it from one direction, we discover that it's got a way of getting around it, or at least partially. But the drugs are very effective. We shouldn't forget that although the drugs will not eliminate infection and you have to stay ahead of all the mutation, there are an awful lot of people walking around today leading productive lives who wouldn't do in the absence of those drugs.
Tell us more about where you think we are now with the new combination therapies that are being used to fight drugs. I mean, a couple of years ago we were hearing that people's viral load was almost disappearing, and you know, that their T cell count was returning to a relatively normal count. Now we're reading that a lot of people are getting resistant to the drugs, that the side effects for some people are kind of intolerable. And give us your reading of where we are with the drugs now.
Well, first of all, I should say that I am not a physician and I don't treat patients. And so what I learn is from talking to people and from reading probably the same things you read. And the picture that I get is a mixed one. I think that for many, many people, the drugs have been literally lifesavers. And there are many people walking around today who have virtually undetected, in some cases undetectable, loads of virus. I mean, that is no detectable virus at all in their blood, and have been that way for years and are maintained that way by constantly taking these drugs, so that the little bit of virus that might dribble out of the latently infected cells gets killed right away by the constant load of drugs in their system. But that's not everybody. And it's not everybody for a couple of reasons. One of them is that there's a large number of patients who were infected a long time ago and who have taken these drugs serially as they've come on the market. So when first AZT came, they took AZT and became resistant to it. Then when 3TC came, they took 3TC and became resistant to it. When the protease inhibitors, what we haven't talked about, came, they took the first one and they became resistant to it, and they took another one and became resistant to it. And now they're serially become resistant to all of the various drugs, and we don't have anything for them right away. There are many new drugs in development, and there's very great hope that even people in this state of having highly resistant virus will be able to be helped in the near future by new drugs. But there's no certainty that we'll ever be able to really deal with the problem that those people have. Then there's a third class of people who are getting infected now with partially resistant virus. And they are unfortunately starting off their infection resistant to a number of drugs, and a physician has to find the right combination to deal with them. Then there are some people who have just such enormous loads of virus that even the drugs that we have don't drive the virus really down to zero, and so they begin to mutate against the drugs. And then, of course, there are the things that you mentioned, the side effects of these compounds. They're not benign compounds. The protease inhibitors cause changes in fat deposition in the body that are causing people to change their whole form and making them very unhappy. And the reverse transcriptase inhibitors are dangerous for the bone marrow and can cause anemias. And so it's a constant medical fight to stay ahead of the disease in the patients in America.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the protease inhibitors, which is a fairly new class of AIDS-fighting drugs. Maybe you could tell us the principle that they work on.
Well, one of the things the virus does when it makes new virus particles is it makes proteins that are actually polyproteins. So instead of having protein 1, 2, 3, and 4, they have a protein that contains the sequences of 1, 2, 3, and 4 all together in one protein. And they package it all this way. And they also package with it a little scissors that can cut up the polyprotein into its individual constituents. And that scissors is called a protease because it cuts proteolytic, it cuts proteins into pieces. And all retroviruses package proteases in the particle, and they all need to have these proteases cut up the polyprotein before they become infectious. So the pharmaceutical industry knew how to make inhibitors of proteases because they're used for controlling hypertension and other diseases. And so they went right to work and devised, as soon as we understood how important the protease was, and devised drugs that will inhibit this protease, and they prevent the particle from becoming infectious. So even though the particle's made, it sits there in an immature form and can't infect another cell. And so they're really quite complementary to the reverse transcriptase inhibitors.
So is this something, are the protease inhibitors drugs that you can become immune to, or do they work in a way that immunity isn't an issue?
No, they're
resistant to is what I meant to say.
Yeah, you can become resistant to protease inhibitors by a virus can become resistant by mutation, mm-hmm. just like it can become resistant to reverse transcriptase inhibitors.
Right.
Any drug binds to a protein, and the protein is made up of amino acids. And by changing the code in the DNA, you can change the amino acids in the protein, and suddenly it won't bind the drug.
My guest is David Baltimore, the chair of the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is David Baltimore, and he's the chair of the National Institute of Health's AIDS Vaccine Committee. He's also the president of the California Institute of Technology. You know, one of the controversies about the development of an AIDS vaccine is how should the vaccine be tested? Who should it be tested on? How much should the person who it's being tested on know about the vaccine? What about placebos and all of that? What do you think are the most important issues now that really need to be examined about the testing of AIDS vaccines?
In the United States, we have a group of people who are willing to be sort of the guinea pigs for the testing of vaccines. As long as we can guarantee to them that the vaccine is safe, it's not going to cause disease, they're willing to take these vaccine candidates and allow people to study their responses to it. And we are blessed that the American population is willing to do that. But we can only test so far in the American population, at which point we have to find a population that's going to have a reasonably high probability of getting HIV infection in the wild. Because when we give them a vaccine, we want to know, does it prevent their getting HIV? And so they have to, in fact, be exposed to HIV in order for that to happen. And there are very few populations in the United States that are the high probability are going to get infected. There are a few. We know the young gay community, particularly gay men, community of gay men is one like that. But there are many abroad. And in fact, the bulk of HIV infections are occurring abroad. And we would like to be able to test vaccines on those populations. Those populations are suspicious of American medicine. They're suspicious of medicine in general. They haven't had, they worry about being guinea pigs for something that'll be dangerous to them or at least won't be helpful to them. So we need to find ways to work with these populations so that they can get the benefit of vaccines, so that we can get the benefit of information about vaccines, and no one's taking advantage of anyone else. So it has to be done in a very open, very clear and explicit way. And this is beginning to happen. You talked about the Vaxgen vaccine. That's going to be tested, or it's just starting to be tested in Thailand. And the Thais have worked closely with Americans in designing the vaccine trials, and a lot of the work will be done in Thailand. So it will also help the development of scientific infrastructure in Thailand. We just started an NIH-sponsored phase 2 trial of vaccine in Uganda, and that is going well. And there are other sites where we're working with people abroad. I think that's a very important part of the vaccine testing program, to be able to work collaboratively and openly with the communities where the infection is most rampant.
And you're confident now that the protocols are such that we're not exploiting the people who we're testing the vaccines on?
There one issue that is most difficult in that regard is whether if somebody in a trial gets infected, do we have a moral obligation to treat them as if they were Americans? That is to give them multiple drug therapy for their lifetime. And I don't think we've really figured that one out, but my impression is that the health authorities in many foreign countries, many underdeveloped countries, so much want a vaccine that they're not really asking for that kind of commitment. But in America, there are groups who believe that we need to make that kind of commitment on a moral basis. And I don't know what the right answer to that question is, but it certainly is at the moment bedeviling the whole vaccine effort.
And these people who are hypothetically getting the HIV virus during the testing, they'd be getting it in spite of the vaccine, not because of the vaccine.
Oh, absolutely. They would be getting it because they'd exposed themselves to virus from prostitutes or from other sexual partners or from IV drug injections or something. And in fact, we have an obligation to counsel them to how to avoid HIV infection, sort of working against ourselves from a statistical point of view, but working in favor of these individuals, because really the best thing we could do is to convince them to simply not expose themselves to virus.
Well, one of the mysteries about AIDS is why is it that there are some people who succumb to HIV very quickly and others who have the virus for years and years and show little, if any, symptoms? Some research seems to be indicating that it might have to do with genetics. I'm not sure whether it's the genetics of the HIV or the genetics of the carrier. But what do we know now that we didn't know before in answer to this riddle?
Well, we know some things about the genetics of the people.
Mm-hmm.
We know that people can have mutations in certain of their proteins that make them resistant to HIV. For instance, HIV has to get into the cell by binding to something on the surface of the cell. And the major protein that's involved in that is a protein called CCR5. Turns out that there are some people who lack CCR5 on their cells. Those people are resistant to infection. And they can be exposed multiple times, and the probability of infection is almost zero. It's not absolutely zero, but it's very close. But if they have just less CCR5 on the surface of their cells, not zero, they may get infected, but then they'll progress in their infection much more slowly. So that's one mechanism, which is a human genetic mechanism of protection. But it's not, I don't think it's the full explanation. And there must be an explanation that involves the immune system, and that one we haven't found yet. We believe that some people's immune system, particularly probably their cytotoxic T lymphocytes, are more effective in controlling HIV than other people's. And what the reason for that is, whether it is truly genetics or it's experience, we don't really know. Then there's a third thing, which is we suspect that there are certain viruses that just cause a less virulent infection. And if they get in there, the disease develops much more slowly.
Well, it must be pretty exciting to be working on something so important and, you know, so essential and timely.
It is exciting, and it's also intellectually challenging because you can see from the questions you've asked how many different aspects of biology HIV impinges on. It's amazing that something which is fundamentally 10,000 nucleotides long, and to put that in perspective, the human genome has 3 billion nucleotides, that something that small can be so daunting, so smart. I hate to use the word smart because it sounds anthropomorphic, but certainly when you're out there trying to understand HIV, it looks smart.
Well, Dr. David Baltimore, thank you so much for all your clear explanations. Really appreciate it very much.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
David Baltimore chairs the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Advisory Committee and is the president of the California Institute of Technology. This is Fresh Air.